Psi n to stay as Psi n. Essentially, for example, if I want my time-dependent state to be approximately the instantaneous eigenstate of the function Hamiltonian at time t, I want this to be true for all m not equal to n. Okay, where this tau, you can think of it as the rate of the change of Hamiltonian. So if you're at time scale much shorter than tau, the Hamiltonian changed very little. The idea is because of that, when this the second term involves terms like this. I mean, it's really an integral, but roughly it looks like this. So because with a time scale much shorter than tau, my Hamiltonian didn't really change anything. But this term is already oscillating like crazy. So that term eventually drops off. Okay. So as I said, the intuitive way to understand it is to say there's an energy uncertainty. That's given by this inverse time scale. Okay. So if this energy uncertainty is much smaller than the energy difference between different levels, then it's very hard for this kind of time dependence to induce a jump between different levels. Essentially, your error is much smaller. The error in energy is much smaller than the energy difference between levels. Well, if the opposite is true, then what will happen is that these levels will mix strongly.
I had a question.
Yes.
Yeah. So I know this argument is used like very frequently.
Yes.
But you said that the oscillating term drops out, but yeah. There isn't a time integral over it. So what do you mean?
Sorry. What do you mean?
This
one. Which time integral are you talking about? Sorry. So in that CN formula, I think this is the only time integral you have.
If it's oscillating rapidly, then so why does it drop out?
Oh. Imagine averaging it.
Oh yeah, exactly.
Yeah. That. Yeah, that kind of argument is used very frequently. Of course, you can question exactly how rigorous that is. I think in this case it can be treated more rigorously, but I can't necessarily put it out of my head.
And what was at the end the physical significance of the momentum magnetic field that we had found?
Oh, the
magnetic field on the momentum space.
Yeah, there the thing is. Okay. Historically, the okay, forget about the history. So, so I talked about the equation of motion you get from that Bloch state, but with the momentum space magnetic field included, right? So there, what you see is there's an extra term. Before, you only have this, right? That's like the normal Newtonian type of mechanics, but now you have additional term. I may screw up the sign. Doesn't matter. Right, it's like the momentum space analog of the Lorentz force.
But that's for not the velocity of actual particles, but the crystal velocity.
Well, so remember these are So you can ask when does this kind of equation can ever apply? After all, I'm talking about a quantum mechanical particle. So this x and k, they really refer to some wave packets. So there is an intrinsic ambiguity in both x and k. Okay. So if I want some, let's say I want the ambiguity in k, for example, to be much smaller than, let's say, what's my scale here? Well, it's the reciprocal lattice finder. Right. Otherwise, I can't talk about k at all, right? Because k is even just defined mod g. But that, you see that delta x, which is a 4 to 1 over delta k, is already much larger than the lattice spacing, little a, which means this x is really a smeared out version of that, of space. So it doesn't actually probe which, exactly which lattice site you sit on. It probes some kind of average. Yeah. So so this is the regime where you can actually talk about equation of motion like this.
But we did switch the labels. Like, we started from position and momentum, and then we switched the labels and said that we can then make this argument about
yes.
what we did.
Yes.
But like, we have a very clear notion of the difference between position and momentum. So how can we make that switch? Like, why is it physically reasonable?
Well, that's the thing. There's no formally the difference between coordinate and momentum is a matter of choice.
But it's a crystal, right? So the momentum is like periodic. Like,
yeah, that's the the thing is as long as you are moving, if you are moving not too, if you are moving reasonably slowly, at some finite period of time, you are moving within a small patch of momentum. Then you're not seeing the actual crystal. So it looks like, it basically looks like an ordinary momentum, except with this twist. Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah, as I said, this is an extremely hand-waving way of doing it. Historically, it wasn't done this way. I mean, if the first paper ever written on this subject is done this way, probably nobody would believe it. Historically, it was done, people realized that you actually calculate the conductivity using what's called Kubo formula. I didn't talk about that, but somewhat related to the, it's related but not identical to the Boltzmann equation approach. So you actually convert the calculation of the conductivity into some correlation function of your many-body state. And from there, people saw that there is an extra term in the whole conductivity that can be interpreted this way. Okay. So by the way, have you guys seen calculation of correlation functions in your QFT classes? You've seen that, and you know weak theorem. Okay, maybe I should have done it that way. Anyway, so at least this one, the physical intuition is there. Okay. It can be justified more rigorously. Yes?
There's one more question online. I'm not sure exactly when it appeared, but I think it's from last lecture. So someone asked, what is an orbit? And what did you mean when you said there's one electron orbit per site?
Oh. Yeah, I'm just saying there's one electron state per site. So the Hilbert space has only one, has dimension one on each site. So our orbit comes from chemistry, right? It's an S orbit, P orbit. But really for us, the only information is how many Hilbert, how many states are there in the Hilbert space of each unit cell. And the general rule is one orbit per unit cell gives you one band. I mean, the two numbers are the same. All right, so and part of the reason why such hand-waving argument is okay is because at the end of the day, at least for insulators, you expect an answer that's integer. So that's what I'm going to show you next. And because the answer is integer, error bar is zero. So it doesn't matter how much hand-waving I've been doing, it's fine. Okay. So recall from last time that the whole conductivity is given by, let me redefine it. C over 2 pi. I mean, if you really put in all the h bar and so on, it should really be e squared over h times c. I've already, of course, usually set e and h bar to be 1. So this number c is defined as e squared k over 2 pi curl k cross a. where, let me call this AK, is defined as the block state array phase. So just stare at this formula. What does it mean? Well, your momentum space, your momentum lives on Brillouin zone. So this is an integration over the Brillouin zone. And remember, Brillouin zone is a torus. It's a closed surface because this edge is identified with this edge, and this edge is identified with this edge. Right. So if you like, you can really write the Brillouin zone like, as a torus. So this expression is evaluating the total number of some kind of magnetic flux over this closed torus surface. So if you take your classical EM textbook, it tells you that number should be zero, right? Because it's the integral of a curl of something that by integration by part that reduced to a surface term. Essentially, this can be reduced to k dot a over 2 pi over the boundary, which is this surface. But this surface is nothing, right? Because this line is really the same as this line. This line is the same as that line. So naively, you say that term should be zero. Right? And that's just that's just your classical your classical EM result saying the total flux through a closed surface, the total magnetic flux through a closed surface is zero. But we know that quantum mechanically that's not correct. That's not entirely correct. You can see that it doesn't have to be zero from this expression, because even though this is a closed surface, this line should eventually be identified with this line. So if this A field is single value, then what I said will be true. If this A is single value, then you take the line integral, because the A here should be same as A here, but I'm taking it in the opposite direction, so they should cancel out. But A is not gauging variant, remember, I said last time. So it doesn't have to be single value. Okay. So what could happen is that the A field here is a gauge transformed version of A field here. That's totally fine. Right? And then I can glue this square back to the torus and get my Brillouin zone.
Sorry, can you explain how that's totally fine? It doesn't sound fine.
No, because let's say this is a periodic system, which means anything physical should be periodic.
Okay, yes.
A is not physical.
Okay.
There's no way for you to measure A.
Okay.
What? Sorry.
But anything physical, as I said, should be periodic. In particular, this guy, that should be periodic.
Okay.
Yep. Another thing is, any line integral that's on a closed line, that should be periodic. That should be single value. Which means even though the A here and the A here, let's say A at plus pi, A at minus pi, let me just call it, let's say AY, right? So this direction. Even though they can differ, but if I take the line integral of A along this line, remember this line should be same as this line. So this, let me call this at pi, minus pi. You say they should be identical because that's gauging variant. Well, not quite, because you never probe this. What you probe is this. Yes, this is the Berry phase, you get by moving a particle along this line. For example, the Berry phase you get by moving a particle along this line. Remember, this is a closed circle because this point is the same as this point. So the Berry phase factor you get in this circle should be the same as the Berry phase you get from this circle.
I'm sorry, why are the edges identified oppositely?
Oh, no. Sorry, they're not identified. Sorry. This arrow means this path of the integration. And I taking the path like this, that gives me the surface integral of the curl A. And this point is identified with this point. This point is identified. It's also ordinary torus. That arrow doesn't represent identification. Yeah. Sorry. This arrow represents this loop, this path of the integration.
What do the opposite edges in the line integral mean? Like one loop you're taking like this, other in the opposite direction.
Sorry?
You said like line integral at point pi, point minus pi. What is, I don't quite understand.
All right. This one?
Yeah.
Yeah, what's the domain of integration?
Yeah. Sorry. Let me write it. Let me write it clearly. So this one is, say this is my Brillouin zone. This integration is over this line. And this integration is over this line. So they're supposed to be the same line, eventually, because they are related by the reciprocal lattice factor. Right. But then the requirement is the integral of this Berry connection. After exponentiating, should agree.
Oh, so the integral above is over four circles?
Yeah. The integral is above, is this circle. This one is this circle, this one is this circle.
But the integral, so if we were calculating the integral over the whole region, over the whole Brillouin zone, we would be integrating over...
Yeah, also this and this, yeah.
So four circles.
Yeah. It's in total four circles. But I'm only doing these two circles at this point. Yes.
Your directional arrows match in the.
Yes.
Should they?
Yes, they should. Because this line is literally this line. I mean, physically, this line is the same as this line. So if I'm moving this way on this edge, that corresponds to moving this way on this edge. So they should. Now, if the statement is they are literally the same without exponentiating, then I'm back to square root 1. Then essentially, you look at this full expression, which is taking in opposite direction, then everything should cancel. But the important statement is they only have to agree after exponentiating, which means the actual integral have to agree only up to 2 pi integer.
So that cyclical integral is just valid because like, it's valid only if you consider the Brillouin zone to become a torus, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's always the torus. Yeah. So now you can make the argument for these two edges as well. Again, they should differ at most by 2 pi times integer. So you conclude that, and because there's a 1 over 2 pi here, you conclude that this is an integer. And if you have seen Dirac monopoles in quantum mechanics class, it's basically the same argument.
So the integer is gauge dependent?
No, it's gauge invariant. This expression is gauge invariant.
So normally, in sort of in like classical mechanics, that would be zero. And now in quantum, we have an integer.
Yes, quantum mechanically, you allow integer. Well, even classically, there actually, no. Okay, it depends a little bit on what you mean by classically. Even classically, there's nothing wrong with having A multivalued. you just have to make sure that they, at the end of the day, they glue back properly. But then there's our, how do you specify the allowed rule of gluing back? What counts as a gauge transform and so on? So that is better defined if you talk about quantum mechanical system. Yes?
What's the range of integration for that?
Sorry, which one?
That
this one?
Yeah.
Yeah. So remember, this is an integration in the entire Brillouin zone. And this is a curl of something. So that by Stokes' theorem, this should reduce to the boundary integral. This is a square. So which means this boundary integral should run just on this boundary. Right.
It's like related to like when you have a compact U1 gauge theory.
Oh yeah. It's compactness is here. You only talk about this thing. You know? So if you know Dirac monopole, what I've told you is nothing but saying, in general, imagine this is a torus embedded into three dimension. You don't have to, but you can imagine that. But then you can imagine putting in some Dirac monopole, magnetic monopoles, into this, into the interior of this torus surface. And then you have a total magnetic field flux on this torus surface.
Could you draw the integral lines on the torus?
Oh yeah, that it looks like this. So that looks like. So this line looks like this one. This line looks like this one. So what you're doing is taking this line, take this line, and then invert it on this line, and then take it back on this line. So. It's a loop that encloses either you can say it encloses the entire torus, or you can say it encloses zero area. Yeah. So that's another way to see that this should be an integer, because if I move a particle in this funny shape, in this funny loop, I better get no Berry phase, because I'm not enclosing actually any area. So I should get a trivial phase, which means 2 pi times integer.
And what was the argument? Why do we consider as observable an integral over only one loop? Because that's...
Oh, you can check it for all the other loops.
But I could say the integral over one loop. Yeah, I don't know why the e to the I integral over one loop is unobservable.
Oh no, this is the Berry phase.
But the Berry phase is over the whole...
No. The Berry phase is defined for any closed loop when particles move around, right? So any loop is a good loop. It's just these kind of loops are more useful.
So, like, I have to imagine an experiment where I change my parameter k over only that loop.
Yes.
I'm a bit confused about where n is coming from in this model.
You mean this n?
Yes.
Yeah, I'll show you an explicit model where this is actually true. But the general statement is you can ask what this is allowed to be, and naively you say it's zero because it's a curl of something. But it turns out you can have an integer.
I was just wondering, how is this integer fixed? Because any integer.
Yeah. At this stage, I'm only telling you it's some integer. I haven't told you what integer it is. That will be model dependent, right? So what I've told you so far doesn't actually depend on what the actual band structure look like. I take any band, as long as it's a single band, right? Non-degenerate. So I can actually define these things like Berry phase and so on. So there's a gap. Then I conclude that this integral has to be an integer. That's the power of it. I don't actually have a model. That means this sigma xy has to be e squared over h times an integer. Now that's a profound statement, right? Because it's profound in many ways. One is, even if I have did some hand waving, or something, I made some error. As long as I don't make an error very large, you know, the integer doesn't come with an error bar. Right? If I continuously deform my system, adiabatically change the ground state of the insulator a little bit, by continuity, this n can't jump from, let's say, 0 to 1, something like that. Okay. That's why for this kind of system, hand wavings are usually OK, basically. Right.
But these are also used for like measuring stuff, right?
Yes. So yeah. Good point. So in fact, this is how you measure h-bar in reality. Right? This is the best measurement of h-bar. So there are certain systems where it's been realized that this is essentially one, or I mean, any integer, but one is probably the best one. Where this number is measured to up to 9 digits. Essentially because it's guaranteed to be an integer, so that your error bar is gonna be very tiny. So as you're at low enough temperature, you don't cause other excitations and so on. And practically, that's how people measure error bar. Measure H bar.
So why do we call it insulator? There's no bound structure here.
Sorry, this one has a bound structure. You mean? Which one? You mean the
insulator, not any metal, any material, but insulator.
Yeah. For insulator, what I said from band structure point of view, I mean there is a more general argument which I will talk about later. But for band theory, this statement is only true if I've totally filled this band. Right? Remember, if I only have a Fermi surface, let's say I only fill partially, then the sigma x y is going to be the integral of the curvature inside this surface, which is now a contractible surface. So now, you know, it will again reduce to a boundary integral, but it's going to be a boundary integral on the Fermi surface, which doesn't have to be integer anymore.
What happens if your if the filled band is just a small part of the Brillouin zone? Like, why don't you take a
You can. This expression still makes sense. Now you just times the distribution function. You get something. You just don't get integer. I mean, it's not guaranteed to get integer.
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that if you have like filled band.
Yeah.
So if you draw that on the Brillouin zone, like one circle. But I take my line integral inside the circle.
Oh yeah, you can.
And it'll be.
It. No. It won't.
What's the difference?
No, I never said the line integral. Any line integral has to be integer.
Sorry.
I'm saying the difference between these two line integrals have to be integer. Any line integral, if you just look at this number, it's not going to be an integer in general. It's going to be some number. So now, actually, let me show an example where this actually happens. Right? Because at this point, the power of this statement is that it's model independent. The statement that this is an integer. But of course, model independent stuff seems a bit abstract. So let me talk about an actual model. And for that, let me go back to graphene, your favorite band structure. Remember that at low energy, you get a bunch of Dirac fermions, at least for the simplest nearest neighbor type binding model. And if I focus on these two Dirac points, I get something that looks like Dirac Hamiltonian times kx. Let's say I focus on this k point, k near k, delta kx sigma x plus delta ky sigma y. Okay. And the one near minus k, let me remind you, it looks like this. Okay. So you can introduce a valley index tau. Tau z. So forget about the delta part. Tau z sigma x plus ky sigma y. Right, tau z is a polymatrix of the z part of the polymatrix in the value.
Why is it called a valley index?
Oh yeah, it's they call these things valley. I mean, it's, yeah, just the shape. It's not particularly sophisticated.
I'm sorry, can you write a little bit bigger?
Oh,
just a bit.
Okay.
No, that was a joke, please.
Let me.
Like 25%.
Yeah.
So there's a prime in the equation above, so.
Sorry?
Also the equation above this, so the equation above is for k goes to k prime?
Oh no, yeah. So this part is when k is around k prime, or minus k. This part is when k is around k. Yeah. Sorry, yeah. So...
Are these delta k x?
Yeah. Really, they should be delta. Let me know. Okay. So remember I told you that this kind of structure is protected by symmetries. So if I break some of the symmetries in particular, I can open up a gap here, right? So I can create something like this structure. So I've shown you, maybe you've shown to yourself, that if I break inversion symmetry, let's say the A sublattice and B sublattice have opposite potential, then I can open up such a gap. There is another way to do it. That is, I keep inversion symmetry, but I break time reversal symmetry. Okay. So remember, time reversal is defined as if I take the original lattice model, the fermion creation operator doesn't do anything, but I goes to minus I. Okay. So how do I break this? Well, typically, if I want to break this, I need a magnetic field or some ferromagnetic order. But at the level of free fermion band theory, there are some simple terms you can write down. So the simplest such term that you can write down that breaks time reversal but keep other symmetry. So I want to break T, keep other symmetry. So that's done by, originally you have a nearest neighbor hopping, but now you also add this term, a second neighbor hopping, but an imaginary one.
Oh, so it wasn't working.
Wait, what?
So it has to be imaginary, right? To break the T, right?
Yes.
Okay, great.
What?
Time reversal operator changes the sign of I.
Yes. So let me make it clear. So this line, let's say if I have this line and this is I and j, this line represents, let me say, I call it t double prime. Let's say this is real. I times ci dagger cj or c, cj dagger ci minus I times ci dagger cj. Remember, previously, if it's a real hopping, then there should be a plus. Now, because this is imaginary by Hermes, if you want it to be Hermitian, then you need a minus. So that's why when it's imaginary or complex in general, you need to specify an error, right? I to j and j to I are not exactly the same. When it's real, it doesn't really matter. So essentially, you turn on a second neighbor hopping like this, with the arrow specified this way. You can check that it preserves all the other symmetry, except time reversal is gone, because under this rule, the C's don't do anything, but the I is flip sign. So this under time reversal will go to minus of itself. Okay. So this is known as the Haldane model. And I encourage you to check on your own that when you actually add this term in, for example, let's be simplistic. Let's say this t double prime, the amplitude is much smaller than the nearest neighbor hopping t. You don't have to have that, but it's simpler when you have that. What happened is that you get a gap in your Dirac spectrum, and the gap is of order g double prime. But it's a very different gap from the one that you get by breaking inversion symmetry. Why is it different? Well, first of all, the symmetry is different, but it turns out this one has c equal to 1, or plus minus 1. So let me show you how roughly how the calculation comes about.
Sorry, in the Haldane model, we have t double prime is much less than t.
Yeah.
What t is that?
Sorry, t is the original nearest neighbor type binding.
Wait, but there's nothing physical about this, right? Like, this is just like...
What do you mean, nothing physical about what?
This is like, it's just like a thought experiment, right? Keeping like imaginary exchange.
Yeah, it's a term you can add if you break time reversal symmetry.
But is there a physical mechanism by which you could generate such a coupling?
Not here. I mean, here you can. You need to put in a gigantic magnetic field or something. It's not very natural. So the experimentally realized ones doesn't come from this model. But this is probably the simplest model, so we like to talk about
it. Wait, but even if we have a gigantic magnetic field, how do you like get imaginary coefficients for the...
I mean, magnetic field naturally gives you some imaginary coefficient. I mean, some complex coefficients, right? Well, okay, even if you have a gigantic magnetic field, you're not going to exactly have this. You're going to have this plus some further neighbor hoppings, some stuff. And in principle, this doesn't have to be exactly imaginary. You can actually choose a complex phase factor here. And it will do the same job. Just imaginary is like the simplest one, right? Because you can see it has an imaginary and real part. The real part is like the ordinary real second neighbor hopping, which doesn't really do anything, as you probably have seen. So it's the imaginary part that's doing the fun stuff.
In the band structure that you drew there?
Yeah.
So your band opens up there.
Yeah.
Why do we have the peaks on the top and the bottom?
Oh, this thing?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, it's in general, that's what you kind of expect, right? If you have here and here, if you want to connect,
compared to that one, I see.
Yeah. Right, and in fact, you can even just write down in the effective Dirac Hamiltonian, write down a term, and it turns out that I won't show you exactly how to derive this, but it can be derived. Well, essentially, you solve this band structure, which you, again, by Fourier transform and diagonizing a 2x2 matrix, and then focus on the near the k and minus k, what you will see is that this t double prime term gets you a term like this, tau z sigma z psi, where this m is proportional to t double prime. Okay, so now this is a massive Dirac equation, Dirac Hamiltonian. Because you can see that these two anti-commute, and they both anti-commute with this matrix. And let me sketch how you actually show that for you. But I think you'll see some of the details in the tutorial. Right. So the idea is this. First, notice that if time, so why do I make such a big deal about time reversal group? Well, because if you have time reversal symmetry, then it's guaranteed that sigma xy is zero, or the Chern number. Sorry, this number is known as Chern number, is zero. And that's because under time reversal, that very curvature, or the curl A, at k goes to minus b at minus k. Right. So for ordinary magnetic fields, you have this, except you don't invert the space, right, under time reversal symmetry. But here you also invert momentum, because momentum is all under time reversal. Right. But otherwise, it looks basically like what you have for ordinary magnetic fields.
Like, it seems possible, but why?
Yeah, you look at how does A transform? Remember, A is this. So this state goes to this under time reversal. I goes to minus I, partial K goes to minus partial K. So A is invariant, but goes to the negative with a coordinate change.
So time reversal here, I thought time reversal here was the exchange of like A and B's.
Sorry?
The exchange of like A and B points in graphene.
No, that's space inversion. Time reversal is like space doesn't change, only time changes. Time changes meaning I goes to minus I. And because of I goes to minus I, momentum flips sign.
Can I show why there's an additional overall minus sign?
Yeah. I'm going to show you next. Because A doesn't change except for the momentum change. B, recall, is curl K cross A.
Mm-hmm.
So A doesn't change, but this part changes. Okay, so remember this. So then B goes to minus B up to the coordinate change. Which means the total integral of B is zero if you have time reversal symmetry. Right, so breaking time reversal is essential if you want anything non-zero, essentially. And so this Hodding model breaks time reversal. So that's a check to begin with. But of course, not every band that breaks time reversal will have non-zero sigma xy. It's just a necessary but not sufficient.
Sorry, I did not follow. We broke time reversal symmetry.
Yes.
And we get our Chern number equal to zero?
No. You break time reversal symmetry, then now you have a chance of having Chern number not equal to zero. If you don't break time reversal symmetry, Chern number is guaranteed to be zero because of that.
Oh, right.
And if that's non-zero, then we would get the current, like the Hall current?
Yes, you get the Hall conductor.
Okay.
Yes. Actually let me do the actual calculation. I won't do the actual calculation, but let's resume in 5 minutes and I'll do the model for you.
This last piece. So the integral of B is zero in what case?
Sorry?
What is the significance of time reversal breaking?
No. If you have time reversal symmetry, then this is guaranteed to be zero.
Oh, okay.
So if you want something non-zero, you better time reversal better have been broken, which is the case for Hodding model.
So the flying a magnetic field to complex.
like, you don't need to have like thing that's been
maybe, yeah, I'm probably starting, but let's resume.
I'm just asking.
All right, so let me show you roughly.
For example, this lecture here.
How the calculation goes.
So, like, if
this part.
It depends what I call a phrase.
Making sense.
I'm trying to get a current
that is weird.
Yeah, that I get. I don't know what exactly happened.
So it turns out for this kind of two bands model, like graphene, where you have two bands, and you open up a gap. Let's say we want to calculate the Chern number of the lower band, which is filled. The calculation is can be simplified quite a bit. So what do we do? Well, remember in general. In momentum space, the Hamiltonian looks like something like this, a 2x2 matrix. Right, that's your graphene Hamiltonian. Because that time reversal breaking term doesn't break translation symmetry, so I can still label everything by momentum, my Brillouin zone. So in general, I can write any 2x2 Hermitian matrix in the basis of poly matrices, right? So this is in the full Brillouin zone. This I'm not focusing near k and k prime at this point. So in general, you can write something like h x k sigma x plus h y k sigma y plus h z k sigma z. Let me pull out the overall minus sign here, just for convenience. Okay, and all the h's are real, right, because it's a Hermitian. Now, so what is the Bloch state? Let me call it just call k. At the lower band, right? There are two Bloch states. So that's just the eigenstates, the upper and lower eigenstate of this. But then let me write the h, x, y, z as an absolute value times a unit vector. Yes?
Sorry, shouldn't there be a identity as well?
Sorry, what?
Like sigma x, sigma y, sigma z, and
oh yeah, okay. Yeah.
Wait, is that trivial time?
Let's set it to zero. In this case it will be zero. But in general it may not. I mean this model has a secret symmetry that actually sets that to zero, but let's not talk about that. So let's just talk about this model. And then of course, the energy at k is going to be plus minus h. Let me just say that my definition is right. You just diagonalize this by the matrix. So let me call the h as a three vector as the magnitude times a unit vector. So this h bar really lives in a two-dimensional sphere, the unit vector. Sorry, this h hat. And now my Bloch state, which is an eigenstate of this Hamiltonian, is essentially an eigenstate, the lower or the eigenstate of this h hat dot sigma with eigenvalue 1. So this is my lower band. Because for this, I get the, because of the minus sign here, I get the lower energy. I pick up the minus sign here. Okay. So this looks like a spin half problem, which presumably should have some experience in your quantum mechanics class. And there is an important result that's saying, which you will see in full detail in your, hopefully in your tutorial. That is, now let me label this, let me call this, since it's the eigenstate of this thing, it's uniquely determined by this unit vector h tilde, h hat. So let me just call it h hat. Okay, you'll have some expression. So in general, you can write it in the two component, it's some alpha and beta. Is a function of each hat. Yes.
Can we go back? So now I think I'm a little bit confused between the second quantized language and the first quantized language.
Yeah. Yeah. So now I'm only looking at this, right? So if you like, if you like, this refers to the, let me call this C's. This refers to a particular combination of the CK, A, B, right? With the coefficient alpha and beta.
And what do you call those, the block wave functions? Because they're already in a second quantized language. That notion.
Yeah, the notion is that, okay, in the second quantized language, you call the C, CK is really a wave function in K. Sorry. Summation over X, X, CX. Right, this is what you do in second quantization. So, so you pull out the wave function from this coefficient. Right. So, if you follow that procedure, because it's quadratic, at this level it doesn't really matter if it's first quantized or second quantized. So you can easily go from this language to the Bloch state kind of language, K-A, K-B, K. You get the same matrix structure there. Essentially, because it's quadratic, everything looks pretty nice.
Sorry, can you summarize what just happened?
the question or the thing before?
I guess the question, but also maybe.
Because you switched the sides.
Yeah.
Like multiple times in your first line. Like you called them CKs, and now we're calling them.
Yeah. Okay.
We had size, and then we had C's, and then.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah. I'll do it. I'll do it carefully. Yeah.
Thank you.
So this CKs really means it's a two-dimensional vector, CAK and CBK. Where CA or BK is the Fourier transformed version of the CA or CB, on, for example, at position X. X refers to the unit cell structure. Right.
There is a negative sign there, right? Beside minus C dagger.
This one?
Yeah, there has to be minus C dagger K, right?
Oh, this one? Yeah, okay, yeah, I mean, just relax. Right, usually, sometimes the psi really means the, if you focus on momentum only near the K and K prime. Let's use that notation. Okay. And the thing is, at this level, if I only care about dispersion, it doesn't really matter if I use second quantized or first quantized language. So you can always replace this thing by a second, by a first quantized state, let's say at position x, a. There's nothing, you get the same dispersion. Of course, when you want to ask about the question like, you know, the ground state should be a field for me, c, with all the negative energy states filled, it's, you know, it's more convenient when you talk about this thing. Yeah, so, yeah, okay. So when I say this, I should really mean, yeah. The lower band, oh yeah, maybe I just use this language. The lower band is really some CK, some alpha CK, A, and which symbol did I use? Okay. C A K beta K C E. Okay. So this is the block state I should be talking about. Okay. So this alpha K beta K, now I can pull it out. It's some two-dimensional vector, complex vector. Okay. And the statement is this vector should be an eigenstate of this 2x2 combinations of Pauli matrices with eigenvalue 1.
How do we know that the eigenvalue should be 1? Like,
now, this is a unit vector times Pauli matrix. The eigenvectors are plus minus 1. So the plus 1 with the negative sign here means it's the lower band. So this thing you've seen, right? Some unit vector times Pauli. Okay, so now a result that you will see in tutorial is that if I now adiabatically evolve this operator with a time dependence, right? So it's a 2x2 matrix with some time-dependent coefficients. But let me keep this this thing on the H to have mod 1. Right? Then and let's say suppose it goes through a closed path, meaning at time 0 and time capital T, the two vectors are the same. So the Hamiltonians come back to itself. So if I draw it on the unit sphere, what does that look like? It looks like some path like this. Okay, so this is my unit sphere. So this is my H. Now a result is that the Berry phase you get with this operation, it's equal to the area enclosed by this H hat T, this curve, divided by 2. Which you can actually just calculate, because for any H hat, you just the eigenstate is something like this. So the Berry curvature will be something like alpha star h hat beta star h hat with a partial with some derivative here. You have to choose a basis. So that's your A, and then you take the curl, you integrate. So
for that, for
like, a priori, we did not assume that H should be a closed loop, right? Like,
no, yeah, I'm saying if it involves over a closed loop. Because if it's an open loop, the Berry phase is not gauge invariant, not particularly meaningful.
So we need, so to do the calculation, we would need the formula for alpha sub a and beta.
You need a formula of alpha beta as a function of this h hat. Right, so you just diagonalize a general 2x2 matrix.
Okay.
Excuse me. Can you go over that again? The loop part?
Sorry?
The last part. The unit sphere.
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay. I'm saying if my Hamiltonian, imagine a Hamiltonian, not this, the fermion one. Just imagine a spin Hamiltonian, two level. That looks like this. And then I adiabatically evolve the H in the fashion that keeps it a unit vector, but then at time capital T, it comes back to itself. Right, so that's adiabatic evolution. I can talk about the kind of thing. In particular, I can talk about the Berry phase. And if you just evaluate that Berry phase, it's the area enclosed by this circle divided by 2.
By circle, do you mean inner?
Sorry,
the arc.
So this H, as you evolve, it spans a path. Right, so then there's an area on the unit sphere that's enclosed by this path. And then the claim is the Berry phase is that area divided by 2.
Wait, so if there was, where is this coming from? Is it the same argument that we were using before, that it's like the flux through this surface?
You'll see that through an actual explicit calculation.
Oh, okay.
So, what do you mean? You can try that. I mean, at each h hat, you can solve for the eigenstate. And then the a is the alpha beta I partial h alpha beta. Right. Use the formula for the Berry connection. Now take the curl of that and integrate. Of course, one thing you may object is to say this area enclosed by the path is not uniquely defined. I can choose the upper surface area or I can choose the lower surface area. It turns out they differ by 4 pi. That's the total area of your unit sphere. And 4 pi divided by 2 is 2 pi. So as a phase factor, it doesn't do. It doesn't matter. So now if you plug this relation in, now you're ready to understand the total Berry curvature of the Haldane model. Right? Essentially, what happened, so let's just be simple. Consider the case where the T double prime is much smaller than T. So consider T double prime, which is the gap. Let me call this mass. Much smaller than T. And it turns out you can solve this quite quickly if you accept that fact. That's because away from, far away from this Dirac point, the T double prime didn't really do anything because I have a gap that's of order t, right? So far away in momentum space, from k and minus k, t double prime doesn't do anything. In particular, the band structure will still look time reversal invariant. Because before you add T double prime, it's a time reversal invariant. Right? And I've told you if it's time reversal invariant, the total chain number is 0. So that means that states far away from K and K prime has no contribution to this integral of B. Which means in this regime, if I want to figure out the chain number, I just look at what happens near the Dirac point. So what happens near the Dirac point? Well, I have a mass that looks like this. But if I move very far away from the mass, let's say I move to an energy that's much larger than the m, or if I move to vk, velocity times k, delta k, much larger than mass, then the mass also looks tiny, right? So I can essentially treat my Hamiltonian as just the Dirac piece. So what does that look like? That looks like some delta kx sigma x plus delta ky sigma y plus a tiny mass sigma z. Right, so that's my Hamiltonian. So now my h is more or less delta k in the x plane, delta kx x plus delta ky y. More or less, with a tiny little bit of z. So the total Berry phase is also the line integral of the Berry curvature, which is the Berry phase. If I move, let's say I want to calculate the Berry phase. Actually, let me do the lower bound. So if I want to calculate the Berry phase coming from this state, I just calculate the line integral of the Berry connection along the circle. That's Stokes' theorem. That's just saying I want to calculate the Berry phase as I evolve my Bloch state, which is now a two-dimensional state along this circle. But by that relation, I only need to calculate how much this thing, how much area this vector winds on my sphere. Actually, you want to normalize this. But this thing, if I neglect the m, what does that do? That traces a full circle on the equator, just on the equator, right? Because if m is zero, then it's literally just a full circle. With a little bit of m, you go a little bit like this. So it's basically half of the area span is basically half of the sphere, right? And that's 2 pi. Divide by 2, that gives you pi. So what you end up finding is that the total Berry curvature from one Dirac cone with a small mass, with a mass m, is pi. Well, there's a sign ambiguity there, because pi is pretty much the same as minus pi. And then that sign ambiguity is determined by, turns out, m. It's determined by whether you are a little bit above equator or a little bit below. Right. And if you do the full calculation, which you now have all the tools to do, it turns out it's plus minus pi, depending on the sign of m. Okay? And now, because in C2 inversion symmetry is still a symmetry, right? You have the C2 inversion symmetry. And under C2, I have B. K goes to minus B. Sorry, it goes to B minus K. This you can show with a very similar argument with time reversal earlier. The only difference is now there's no extra B. There's no extra minus sign here. Which means, because K and minus K, the KK prime are related by C2, which means you have the same contribution from k and k prime, which means the total Chen number is just 2 times whatever I had above, which is 2 pi. Sorry. I have to divide that by 2 pi, which is just 1 times sine of m. Essentially, depending on the sine of m, which is determined by the sine of t double prime. In a way, I haven't showed you, but you can check that yourself. The total Chen number is going to be plus minus 1. Okay. So there are a couple steps I jumped through, and I encourage you to go through that actual calculation explicitly. So this is telling you that if you start from a graphene, you break time reversal, you get an insulator. Or alternatively, you can keep time reversal and break inversion, you also get an insulator. These two insulators are very different. Not only do they have different symmetry, I mean, that's certainly an important difference, but they also have different Hall conductance. And because the Hall conductivity is quantized in integer, there's no way you can continuously or adiabatically tune from one to the other. So this is part of a more general phenomenon. So let me just give a brief comment. How do we think about a band? Well, in the old days, when we think about a band, essentially you think about a dispersion, something like this. So E versus K. But the band certainly has more information than just a dispersion. I mean, dispersion is certainly a very important aspect. But the other aspect is this Bloch state. Let me put in back the K, the U. Right. Because in general, they can be different at different K. In fact, that's what happens with this Hordain model, right? So really, one way to think about a band is to say that I have a Brillouin zone, which is a torus. Let's say two dimension, right? Then you have a T2. And then on every point of that torus, I have a state. Well, in general, if I have some degeneracy, I have multiple states. So in general, on every k point, I actually have a Hilbert space. And in the simplest case, which we consider here, it's a one-dimensional Hilbert space. It's pretty simple. Then generally, you can ask, how do you put these two together? Right? Your band is specified by a Hilbert space living on each momentum point. So if it's a trivial product, in our case, this means that the Bloch state is completely identical on all momentum points. Then we say this is a pretty trivial band. Right? For this band, for example, you can try to do inverse Fourier transform and get a real space picture, and the insulator you get by filling this band will pretty much look like the atomic insulator we talked about yesterday. And in mathematical jargon, that's called a trivial bundle. Right? Because when I try to say on every point in this torus, I assign a Hilbert space, I'm secretly already doing fiber bundle. A non-trivial band means that somehow this Hilbert space winds in some non-trivial way over this torus. Right. So in general, classifying topologically distinct bands is like a problem in fiber bundle, classifying different bundles. So for a one-dimensional, for this kind of bundle, it's essentially a U1 bundle. And on a torus, and that has been classified, or at least in some simple cases. And it's classified precisely by this chain number, this integer chain number.
How do we know this U1? Because block states are U1?
Well, in the simplest case, it's you only have one dimensional Hilbert space.
Okay.
So when you go from one point to the other, the only thing that can change is a phase factor.
Right.
Yeah, that's a U1. Yeah, but if I have more complicated structure, for example, I have some other symmetry that guarantees that at each, for example, momentum point, there's a degeneracy. So there are two states that are degenerate. Then I get a more complicated structure. And then the classification will be different, and so on. So that that area is known as the topological band theory. Any question so far? Yeah, that's actually just a side comment.
Could one connect through this geometrical picture? Could one connect, because here we have like the same geometrical picture that somebody doing gauge theory would obtain out of considering electromagnetism of a complex scalar field on the torus.
Okay.
Are they related?
Not directly. I mean, the math structure looks similar, but physically, it's not directly related. Actually, you can relate them, but it's not. Yeah, it's pretty indirect. All right. So that's band theory.
It's not a direct product or a naive product of Solaski. I mean, like, what kind of population is there between torus and Hilbert space?
Sorry?
If it's not a naive, like, a product, on the torus, like, each point is having a
space. You mean what symbol represent that?
Yeah.
Yeah, that symbol becomes the symbol for fiber bond. It doesn't. I forgot. I even don't remember what that's.
What do you mean in your language that like it's, the Hilbert space is one?
Okay, maybe I shouldn't put that comment. It's more confusing than you remember. Essentially, this is an example of non-trivial winding. Chain number is not zero. Yeah, because the statement is if it's direct product. You can define the phase factors of this block states globally. Okay. But it turns out for term band you cannot, for these reasons.
Do you have any suggested reading? So the suggested reading for something with this geometrical flavor is the suggested readings that
the reference I listed last time. Should be a good replacement. I mean, there are even more formal literatures on this. I didn't list last time, but if you prefer more formal stuff, I can give you some. Yeah. So, actually, I have. Yeah, not sure if the time left is enough for me to start.
So these insulators is actually called the Chern insulator.
Yeah, okay, sorry. An insulator with Chern number non-zero is called Chern insulator. Yeah. And it's also called the integer quantum Hall effect because the Hall conductance is integer. And by the way, this E squared over H is known as the natural unit for conductance.
Like, you can get a Chern number only if there is, like, you're breaking inversion.
No, you have to break time reversal. Inversion doesn't matter. You may or may not keep it. Sorry. That band structure doesn't break C2. You can actually check. I think. Yeah. It doesn't really break C2. yeah, inversion is not very important for chain number. Time reversal is. Actually, space reflection is. Time reversal is like reflection in time. So if you do a space reflection, it turns out the chain number should also change size. So if you have space reflection symmetry, chain number is zero. All right, so yeah, next time I want to talk about how robust are all this. So after all, I've done, and this looks like some special structure of the band theory, right? So you know, you can say how robust it is, right? Suppose I now go to a regime where I can't really talk about band theory. For example, I add some impurity in my system, so translation symmetry is gone. Right? I can't even talk about Brillouin zone and so on. Or if I add a little bit of interaction into the system. So it's not a free fermion problem anymore. So again, some of these tools I've been using cannot be applied. Then you can ask, does this result still hold? Can I still assert that as long as I have an insulator, this sigma xy has to be integer? It turns out that's still true. Right? So so for this part, I've shown you a momentum space picture of the Hall conductance. So next time, I'll show you a real space picture. You also learn what happens if I have an edge of the system. I have an open boundary condition. I probably only have 5 minutes to start talking about that. That's probably not a good idea. So let's just stop here today.